not going to seem to me.
This is not going on.
Structured discussions.
So what we're going to do now is we're going to have three difficult conversations in small groups of three. I'm going to give a little bit of background on each of the three areas. The three areas that we're going to do is digital challenges, number one, bouncing off of a scenario. All the scenarios are real life stuff that will look all too familiar to everybody. After digital scenarios, we're going to do something on boundaries. Also, coming from a real life, how to protect yourself possibly from false allegations, but also some of the ways that that educators might get pulled into situations that they don't even realize. Can lead to difficulties because of boundaries violations. I'll talk about some guidelines on that, and then we'll do some questions, how to handle questions about faith. We don't have nearly enough time to do justice to any of them, okay? But in keeping with the idea of going immediately, not being about content, but being about the process of having small discussions, hopefully it'll be helpful. So the first thing I don't think I have on the PowerPoint, so I'm going to just talk it out. That's the thing I just gave out. It's three mindsets to facilitate planned discussion. There isn't anything here that you don't know about. I'll just share with you a study. Huh? Oh, sure. Here. Share with you a study. Are you sure you're not Dr. Stone?
Thank you.
You positive, everybody? You're not Dr. Stone? So I'll just share with you a study that's epitomized by three words in Sefer Hasidim. Sefer Hasidim, going back to the Middle Ages, he had three words that epitomizes what we're talking about at this, in this introduction. Acharis kitata charata. After argument, there's regret. And there's one study in particular that always stuck with me, which is where they asked a group of teachers how they felt about various difficult conversations they had with parents who were challenging. And virtually 100% of the teachers said, when they looked back on it, the single most powerful predictor of how they felt about how they handled the situation was if they were able to not lose their temper. They're able to not lose their cool. So the key is, how do you develop the ability to have a mindset where you don't take things too personally, right? So here, if you go to the number one, the first slide, is basically the mindset you want is to get curious rather than be certain. Like, get curious, what could they be thinking? What could they possibly be thinking? As soon as you do that, you're going to your frontal prefrontal cortex. You're not going to be necessarily driven by the more primitive part of your brain that's going to lose your cool looking at this from a neuroscience kind of standpoint. And it's just a matter of being able to get intellectually curious, try to get into their head, because it's often the key to not being quite as upset and not bouncing back anger at them. The next is tolerant distance. It's the mindset you have. If your own child at home is being obnoxious, it's going to be very hard to keep your cool. But if it's a neighbor's child, or if you're in a waiting room and there's an obnoxious kid waiting for the doctor, you're going to be able to have a tolerant distance, okay? And to be able to cultivate that kind of mindset, which is a different part of the brain, but to be able to pull back helps. And finally, when you bring empathy, when you bring being able to be nosei olam chaveiro in terms of caring for the person, trying to figure out where they're coming from, a very quick vignette. That kind of captures this, and I'm going to have to be very careful with time because we're very, or maybe we'll just do two. We'll see. or maybe just one. Or maybe we won't even get to that. There was a woman who told me she was it was a man who was the head of school in a school right in this area, and he told me that he was being tortured by a mother who was constantly complaining about the way the head of school handled behavior problems that her 9-year-old son had. That's bad enough, but to make it worse, she would call the chairman of the board and the president of the school 3-4 times a week to complain bitterly, and would try to get the parents of the school on board with email campaigns to get rid of this head of school. And no matter what he did, it didn't help, okay? She comes to him in April and says, I just want to tell you, I'm moving to Israel, I'm leaving the school, you're not going to have to deal with me anymore, I'm out of here. And he told me he wanted to have a sudas hoda, like, you know? He wanted to literally have a celebration because he was so happy to get her out of his hair. That September, he gets a phone call from her, and she was crying. And she said, how can I ever apologize enough? She said, what was happening during that whole period of time, I was being badly physically abused by my husband. And I realized that I couldn't possibly deal with it directly because it would have endangered my life. And I think she says, now that I look back on it, I was unconsciously displacing it all onto you because you were safe. That's what heads of school do for a living, right? You were safe. And he said what that did to his perception of her. This is a woman who he had such a hard time. He probably wished her dead many times. By the way, there's a whole body of research I've been getting into, and if you really want to read a fascinating book, The Better Angels of Our Nature by Pinker, by Dr. Pinker at Harvard. So the book that Bill Gates said is the single most powerful and best book he ever read in his life. And most high-level university students going to Ivy League school consider him to be their hero. And they think one of the reasons for that is because he's very much into positive psychology and neuroscience and thinking about things without getting pulled down into the gutter. You know, you always do much better when you think up instead of thinking down. When you're able to go up to the frontal prefrontal cortex and think about what there is to be grateful for and think about the strengths you see in others, you do much better and you're a much more inspiring leader when you allow yourself to be driven by your anger, by what's behind your nose in terms of okay. So that's that. Understanding that a control parent, a lot of this is almost simplistic, but I'll say it anyway. So you look at it, first of all, on the physiologic level, huh?
Which of the three were you just describing? Was that?
I was making it up.
You're making it up.
Okay. Which of the three was I just describing?
Yeah, in terms of this.
I was doing pieces of all of it.
Pieces of all of it, yeah.
And now we go to the middle, so we already did, in a way, middle left, okay? The middle left, which is understanding that a control parent is the story I just gave you as an example. And the idea is the more powerless you feel, the more likely you are to try to achieve control through intimidation. And to the extent that you could do that, it doesn't excuse the behavior of an obnoxious parent, but at least may mean you're not going to get pulled into it as much. Here's one tip for dealing with out-of-control parents, just on the cognitive level. There's a story told about Rav Nachman. This chassidim came running over to him one day and said, Rebbe, the misnagdim are saying horrific things about you. And his answer was the mantra I have going on in my head when I get pulled into people who are driving me crazy with various kinds of difficulties that we're describing here. Here's what Reb Nachman said. You can write this down and hang it up on your refrigerator the way Reb JJ told us to, okay? Here's what he said. He said, I have nothing against them. Because they have nothing against me. They only have something against the person they think I am, and he deserves it. I'll say it again. They only have something against the person they think I am, and he deserves it. That's the ultimate cognitive kind of reframe. Okay? As the Baal Shem Tov said, "B'makom shemachshavto shaladam shamhu nimtza ha'ish." You want to know where the person is? See where his or her thoughts are. And to the extent that you could massage that, it makes an enormous, enormous difference. I think what I'm going to do just to, you could read this on both sides, and it's all kinds of ways of talking about going from blame to contribution, looking at, but I think I'm going to end this section with just a simple kind of thought that I learned from Rabbi Dr. Feuerman, okay, a blessed memory, because he taught me these two things I'm about to tell you. You know what? They're better than any of the psychological stuff. The first thing he taught me was, what do you do when you have no control in a difficult conversation over the way the person on the other side is dealing with you? Okay? Let's say you have absolutely no control over it, and you try to talk to them, you try to make peace with them, you try to have a reciprocal conversation, and they're not interested. They're just angry and driving you crazy. So the first thing that Rabbi Feuerman taught me was the following. It was the Teferis Yisrael, written in the early 1800s, in the Yochanan Boaz Mishnayos on Perek Dal and Avavos. And here's what he says, Mikom Lamdai Hiskalti. What he says is the following. He says, your friends are going to tell you what you need to know. They're going to tell you what you need to know in life because they don't want to hurt your feelings. You're not going to grow from the input of your friends the way you'll grow from input of your critics. He says, but when you have a critic giving you constructive feedback, even if it's totally unfair, here's his lasha: Yaseh oznecha ka'aparcheses beruach shalva v'sheket. He says, here's what you have to do. Cup your ears with one of those listening tools, wide on the outside, funneling into the inside of your ear, so you hear every word in a spirit of peace and tranquility, he goes on to say. These people are going to teach you what you need to know. Even if it's 90% unfair or 95% unfair, to the extent that you have the humility to look at your role in it, it's going to help you with your anger, and there's usually something that you could grow from what your critics tell you, however unfair it feels. Not easy, because it's rare that it's in relative contribution that it's 100% them and 0% you. There's always a piece you can look at. Here's recommendation number two on how we, when we have no control over the situation, we always have control over the meaning. Now, don't worry, when we get into the difficult conversations, we'll have more in the way of content for the areas. But this is the final thing. It's a story some of you may have heard from me, a story that Rev Willig said at an RCA convention. And there were hundreds of rabbis there. It was the opening session. And the session was, what happens if you're in a community where you don't get along with your competitors, with other rabbis, other educators, or whatever? And this story, years later, the rabbis who were there tell me this story made a huge difference in their ability to deal with the stress of conflict and difficult conversations. And here's the story. The Chofetz Chaim says the following. He says, every year, it's destined that we're gonna have a certain amount of tough times. It's just the way the world works, okay? For some people, the tough times may come with financial difficulties. For some people, the tough times may come in the form of basically, it might be shalom bayis problems. It might be, God forbid, a loss in the family. It might be health issues. There are a lot of ways that start to depress everybody. We all know. We're all living on Gesher Tzar Mod, on a very narrow bridge, and tough things could happen. We tend to underestimate the odds, according to the social psychology research, of tough things happen. But then he goes on to write the Chofetz Chaim. If you're really, really lucky, some of your tough times are going to come from somebody insulting you. He goes on to say, better to be from the love him that ain't I'm all of him. Always better to be from the insulted person, not the one doing the insulting. And he says, if you're lucky enough to be on the receiving end of somebody's anger, somebody's harsh, unfair words, he says you should be the kabbalin, his lashon is b'chalilin. It's like a bar mitzvah, like a chalil. Says, you should dance with joy. So Rabbi Willig, one evening, many, many years ago, when his family was very, very young, was about to start dinner. And phone rings. And it's one of his congregants, the young Israel of Israel, screaming at him and cursing him, screaming at the top of his lungs, like totally out of control. And he's saying, whoa, 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 I don't even know what you're angry about. That got the guy even more furious. What do you mean you don't know? He was screaming, and the family was getting nervous about it, and it was like out of control. Suddenly, Rabbi Willig has this Chafetz Chaim go through his head. And he holds the phone away over his head, and he starts dancing around the kitchen, just like that Chafetz Chaim says. He said his wife wanted to call the men in the white coats and take him away, okay? And that was the end of it. He never found out what it was until that Erev Yom Kippur. That Erev Yom Kippur, he gets a phone call, and it's a phone call from this man saying, Rabbi Willig, I don't blame you if you never forgive me. It's true. A rabbi in town did something terrible to me. It wasn't you. I was told it was you. You have every right to never forgive me, but I was hoping an Erev Yom Kippur, you could find it in your heart to forgive me. Of course, he forgave him. But the bottom line here is, if you take the general guidelines to be understood first, understand. Ozen Maznayim, right? There's a connection between our ears and Maznayim, the scale, the source of inner balance, okay? Remember to get curious. And maybe when you have no control whatsoever, to bring in some of this wisdom in terms of Elu HaMochichem HaNe'emanim, we could always change the meaning of what it means to us. Not easy, but it's a way to go. Case scenario number one we're going to do is a real live situation with internet base. So, yeah, you can put it up and I'll give out hard copies the way they used to do in the old country. There you go. Okay, here it is. It is. Here's the scenario. Here, I'll just take it away. Okay, the scenario, yeah, you don't mind, thanks. The scenario is the top left. And then there's the thing. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is not. This, there's a separate page for the scenarios. Okay, scenarios, and then that's the content. Okay, here we go. This is coming up. Okay,
this is it, right?
You can all tab. That's the same. Yeah, you know, we'll start with the scenario, and then we'll go to the PowerPoint. So here's the. This is a true thing that happened. Across the bridge in Manhattan a few years back. Okay, here's the scenario. Can you see it? Okay.
It's not. This
no. Okay, you're getting a hard copy. You're good? Okay. Otherwise, no more. You're going to get a hard time. Okay? Here it is. You ready? In a modern Orthodox elementary school in a large metropolitan area, virtually all the fourth grade students have cell phones. By the way, average age in most modern Orthodox elementary schools in Manhattan has gone down from what I'm hearing down to about second grade. And that's happening in secular schools in certain parts of the city as well. And that's what's coming your way. Okay, then what happens is fourth grade teacher in school, you're shocked to see a group of your students looking at blatantly pornographic pictures on one of your students' cell phones. It's a girl's cell phone. You approach the girls and explain how appropriate their behavior is, and you confiscate the cell phone. The principal of your school fully supports your action. That evening, the student's mother angrily demands that you return the phone to her daughter. You calmly explain the reasoning behind your action, and the mother angrily hangs up on you. The next morning, the student comes in with a brand new iPhone that her mother purchased. That's the discussion. We're going to divide into group of threes, but if it's okay, can I spend like 5 minutes going over some thoughts on content on digital guidelines, or should we just go right to the role plays?
Yeah,
We're good? Or should I do some content, or should we go right?
Yeah.
Here's the content, okay? So the content goes like this, okay?
Digital challenges and role of parents?
Yeah.
Which one you want? That one?
Okay, so here we go real quickly. Okay, number one, if you go deep into literature on the best way of dealing with pornography in terms of as educators and as parents, study after study after study shows balance between love and limits. An authoritative discipline style, JJ just said, okay, you want to find that middle path between love and limits, and that's what tends to work best. If you respond when you find pornography in a very powerfully negative, angry, punitive way, it's going to go underground. Kids can get pornography anywhere nowadays. If you don't respond at all with some kind of limit setting, obviously it's such a powerful force, it's going to pull kids in. And what's negative about it? The problems are that there's a lot of research showing it will greatly impact on boys in particular in terms of their view of sexuality. It basically teaches them to have a view of sexuality that's self-centered, blunted, the opposite of kedusha. It teaches them to have totally unrealistic views of what women should look like. And for women, it has equally negative effects in terms of what it does to their self-concept. You know, there's a huge literature on it, and it's something that I think is particularly problematic in our community, because the research shows that the rate of pornography addictions in our community is probably worse than in other communities. How do we know it? First of all, we know it anecdotally. The real way we know it is the research done in fundamentalist parts of the country. If you look at a map of internet searches for pornography around the United States, and you see where is there the most addiction to pornography, the most use of pornography, it's the fundamentalist sections of the United States, with the people who go craziest about how you shouldn't be using pornography at all. But by a lot. Why? Because if I tell everybody, don't think of a pink elephant, don't think of a pink elephant, don't think of a pink elephant, what do we all do? And we know that, we just know, just from all the people who specialize in dealing with pornography use, including among rabbis, among members of our community, we seem to have more of a problem than the general population does for that reason. So it makes it all the more important to have education about it. Actually, Debbie Fox is coming to my office on Tanis Esther. It's part of a film series. She's doing a video of me talking to a kid about basic sexuality. We're not doing that with kids. And you know, we're working on trying to do something about that on a more global community standpoint. So anyway, that's that authoritative style. That's number one. Here's another thing. Most kids want parents to be stricter. They want parents to be stricter. So what Debbie Fox did, which was amazing, she did a study in California, and she asked them a simple, simple question. Here was her question. When you have teenagers of your own at home, how are you going to handle digital challenges differently than your parents handled the internet with you? Most of the kids said, when I have a teenager of my own, I'm going to be much stricter. Okay? So that's just one other piece on that. And here's the general guidelines. Be reasonable, set reasonable expectations. Be open with your teens, encourage them to come to you. They encounter a problem online. Okay, and if you're too punitive, you don't. The general recommendations, I have a contract that's part of the materials that we posted, which is it's these things, which, again, we can make available to you. I think we have some of our stuff available to everybody digitally.
No, we can't.
So I have sample contracts and things. And every time I go to a community and talk to high school kids alone, once you kick everybody else out about the internet, and I ask them, what would you do? They almost always say, I'd be stricter about our use. They want the guidelines. They really do. But they want it reasonably.
So there are some specific kinds of ideas. We have the American Academy of Pediatrics contract we could share with you, but also from Dr. Gold, who's a very liberal, secular child psychiatrist across the bridge in on the east side of Manhattan, and her stuff I find very helpful and very good. So let's go to the scenario. Groups of three. What we'd like you to do with the groups of three is one person should be the teacher or the head of school. The other person should be the parent who comes in furious demanding the iPhone back. And the third person should be the observer and observe and give feedback on how the difficult conversation went. Okay? So just do 3-3-3. So here, it looks like here. Got away. Bar the door. Bar the door. Oh, you're back. Oh, I was close to coming. Come. Huh? Oh, thank you. Oh, so that was really good. That was excellent.
If you're an uneven number, find yourself three.
Okay, we all have some here.
I think one thing our group noted was that if the teacher or principal in the situation can start by recognizing where there are shared values and where there's agreement,
right,
sort of narrow down the scope of what the argument is so it's not a huge, everything you're doing is wrong.
Right.
That might be easier.
Right. So again, it's that positive psychology kind of an approach, and it really can make a difference. Okay, good. Thank you. And how about you guys?
First of all, we had a great group over here.
I saw that.
Excellent.
By the way, thank both.
They think they were really engaged.
The first thing that I learned as a teacher was first to state the problem, frame what's going on, because we didn't get right to the tangent, and for us it's the issue, and then the administrator stepped in and helped us understand we didn't investigate properly of the problem that was between the child and the teacher. So that was important as well. Just to make sure we have facts and know exactly, and then be able to frame that and take care of that.
Thank you. How about you guys? What's the bottom line number of wisdom that you took from this?
So our side, we tried to make it about a teachable moment. Remove the phone as a stumbling block to the conversation and try to make it more about what can be learned by everybody in this situation.
Right.
So we can go forward positively as opposed to being hung up on the loss of the phone.
Right. So by pulling the phone out, it causes a paradigm shift. So it doesn't become a power struggle, it becomes a bad embroidery struggle. Good.
Our side had pretty much the same approach. That without, the school without the policies and the teacher sort of reacted without, it became about the phone, and then there was no proactive conversation with the parents that there should have been.
Okay, right.
A positive conversation.
Good. Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, last time I did this as a trigger for discussion, what came out very strongly is it just shows how important it is for a school to have a mindful kind of policy about all this. What's allowed in school, out of school, things like that. How about this table? Let me hear from both sides.
I think the conflict resolution worked out really well. I'm kind of administrator for faculty members who deal with it. When they moved away from the students and the mom, and it came out to having a focus on educating the students of why this is occurring.
So everybody's taking very similar kinds of approaches, which is good.
We ended up in a situation where we had a really unreachable mom.
Uh-huh.
And I think sometimes it's not being afraid to stand by your convictions, and if you have someone who is really never going to come to
conversation was really in between the mother and the head of school, and they actually were on the same page eventually, but the outcome was that the mother was going to take the child out of school.
Oh,
so
okay.
The outcome was was not what you would think that it would be from the fact that they were on the same page.
She'll be back.
She didn't want she'll
to. I guarantee you. She'll be back.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next vignette is, again, from a real-life issue I dealt with last year, and one that I'm sure that many of you are struggling with. It's called Maintaining Appropriate Boundaries. Thank you. And it's it starts with this vignette, which I'll read out loud here. I want to spend a few minutes talking about things that you know, but sort of how do you protect yourself from false accusations of abuse? I get pulled into this on such a regular basis from different parts of the world that I think it's just important to review. By the way, to me, the single most common situation where educators go down a slippery slope, nobody ever wants to do such a thing deliberately. It usually has to do with online disinhibition effect. It's people who don't have clear guidelines on when to have communication with kids. And there's communication with kids at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And then it comes out that somebody says, wow, this is so inappropriate. And you read it, and the educator doesn't mean for it to be sexualized, but it's easy to read sexualized kind of content into these interactions. And just remember, I'll just say one thing on this. Remember General Petraeus, right? General Petraeus, one of the most decorated generals in recent history of the United States, right? Head of the Afghanistan War, brilliant man, gets job as the head of the CIA, top spy in the world, right? Knows more about secure communication than anybody in the world. And one day, he takes his cell phone, and he texts his mistress, making plans to get together and sharing some blatantly sexual stuff, somehow forgetting that it's the least secure form of communication. Anything you text could be picked up by anybody. And this is the top spy in the world. He knows more about this than anybody. But that's the online disinhibition effect. There's something about being alone with your phone or your computer, especially the research shows when there's no eye contact with the other person, that you just go a little bit awry in terms of your internal controls. It's easier to be cruel, and it's easier to violate boundaries. So here I'll just do a couple of, first let's do today's this vignette. I'll read it out loud. It's the top left of the handout to you. Mrs. Perlstein has been on your high school staff since September, viewed as a warm, competent, and dedicated science teacher. Another member of your general studies staff shares with you that when she passed Mrs. Perlstein's room, she saw her braiding the hair of a 10th grade girl. Not exactly sex abuse, right? They were alone in the room. Such behavior by faculty is an explicit violation of the behavioral standards outlined in the faculty handbook. And I might add that sometimes when somebody's going to eventually perpetrate abuse on kids, they start grooming that way. Now, this obviously, I don't think anybody here would say it was abusive, but it is of some alarm because she's doing something directly against what the guidelines are in the school. And what does that mean? And it may be nothing. I actually came into this school with an in-service yogi on this stuff in a way that in no way shamed her. And my sense of it, and spending some time with her, was this was not coming from her being in any way anything other than just sort of like, you know, she just sort of lost her boundaries for a bit, I hope, okay? So, as this Perlstein's direct supervisor, you set up a meeting with her to discuss this incident. So I purposely picked something in the Arafel, right? In the mist. This is a scenario in the mist, because that's where sometimes, you know, at least I'm most challenged. Okay, we're good? Okay, here's a couple of quick guidelines. This is just the behavioral standards developed by, adapted by a number of organizations. It's pretty much standard stuff, but it's worth a review, okay? And I imagine you all have this in your schools. Okay, you can't be alone with a kid in an area that potentially can't be seen or observed by other faculty members. You can't be in a locked classroom. Doors equipped with windows to permit external viewing. Physical force may never be used other than to safeguard against immediate physical danger. Also, this goes with what you do with words. You can't denigrate a student publicly or privately. Never forbid students to share conversations. I had a situation a couple of years ago where a kid comes in to me and says he had been sexually molested by his Rebbe. And he went into tremendous detail about it. So I start seeing him to figure out what the next steps are, just to figure out, is there a police report here? By the way, that's not, in most states, that's not a police, it's not a child protective service report, right? Because the parents did the right thing immediately. It's a police report, right? Because it's not with a member of the family, it's with somebody outside of the family, but it may depend on your state. But he says, well, let me show you what this guy is like. And he calls he shares with me a message that this Rebbe called him and said, look, we have a special relationship, okay? And whatever you do, don't tell your parents because you won't be able to have the special relationship anymore. And I know that you wouldn't do that to me. Now, of course, that became the leading exhibit in this man's trial, okay? Not very smart. But as a general guideline, never forbid students to share conversations or information with parents or administration, no matter how innocent it might be. And then the rest of this is pretty obvious. We already talked about digital communication. And then there's more stuff here on the dangers of charismatic leadership. Not for now, but it's worth reading this when you get a chance because it's guidelines I got from a group of women whose husbands work a lot with high school age and with older girls, adolescent girls. And some of the things they see and are made uncomfortable by in that work, which is admittedly innocent, but it becomes sexualized sometimes in a way that makes the wives uncomfortable. So I once met with a group of these women, and they told me things. The main thing is to ask yourself a question. Would you feel startled when you're meeting with this girl if your wife walked in? Even if there's windows and it's not, you're doing nothing against Yehud or anything like that. Is something more going on non-verbally here? And that's, you have to look inside of yourself in terms of that kind of stuff. And then nowadays, there's the new, we had this, I don't want to say this. Do I have permit? Let me ask you something.
Person in the room.
Yeah, so in a certain school that'll remain unnamed, a woman was having a parent-teacher conference that night, and she was dressed up nicely. She was looking. She had makeup on. She looked differently than she usually does. And this high school kid, as I understand it, innocently said, "Oh wow, you really look beautiful," or something like that. I don't know exactly what
it was.
Commented
on like eye makeup or something.
Yes, beautiful eye makeup. Now,
yeah, just to be, I think they're not even using the word beautiful.
Yeah, good. They said you have this really nice eye makeup. That would have been totally fine maybe 6 months ago, certainly 6 years ago. In today's climate, we have to teach our students in a high school and ourselves not to comment on appearance. Okay, you don't comment on appearance in another person in a way that can in any way be sexualized. And it's a new set of rules. So you have to deal with these added gedarim that didn't exist in the past. Is that an accurate story?
So what happened?
So you want to tell us what happened in this hypothetical case?
The boy, again, he didn't, it was not a comment on you, he just comment on the makeup. She was taken aback by it. The administration and the boy's not very attuned to social nuances. And he's both with the parents and really outlining this conversation. The fact that it's not something you should not comment on a teacher nor a woman's appearance or anything like that.
Okay, I think we're going to go to the role play. Okay, so remember we have the role play. Remember what it is. It's your. So the same thing before, you want to mix up the groups you can. You want to go out of your zone of comfort. But otherwise, the main point here is this: you're one person is the supervisor of this teacher who is braiding the teenage girl's hair. And then the third person, and please mix it again.
If you play the role of the educator in the last one, so this time, everybody gets them that. The observer should not be the observer. It's not fair to be the observer.
I wonder if that is.
What feedback? Let me hear from you guys. Feedback on this one. Any advice for us? Okay. Okay.
Welcome back. Any observers
here who
want to
share?
We just had a conversation afterwards about whether it was a good strategy to talk about the violation of the policy, the fact that, or the underlying issue of the relationship between teacher, the appropriate relationship between teacher and student at the appropriate distance, whether speaking about we had a policy and this goes against it, what is a productive or a non-productive thing, or just focus on the actual.
Right. And what do you decide?
Well, it was kind of back and forth between whether or not it was a contractual relationship or a trust relationship with that you're describing with the teacher. Because if you're a contractual relationship, if you broke policy and therefore this would be a problem versus trust, but I'm trying to, you know, the teaching head person is trying to build up the person and say, this is really not how you do this. And there's a few different kinds of relationships.
I'm not sure I agree. So just
yeah, let's hear.
I think you build trust by being clear. And if it is a policy issue and you're not thinking the teacher did anything wrong, then you say, this is a policy. You might not have known, and you very clearly say you broke the policy, and that builds trust because they know where you're coming from.
Well, I will push back and tell you two things about it. One is that if the teacher already knows the policy and they're ignoring it, because it says in the setup that the teacher, it's clearly a violation, so that we assume the teacher somehow knows that it's a break of policy. And they have to ignore the policy already. So when you have to end with the statement of, if this is after this, a pattern of behavior, you have to do X.
My sense is that
but
those teachers do not know what's inside of the policy, that's actually, even if they're in the handbook, even if you went over it beforehand. So I'm starting from the point of assuming the teacher doesn't.
Yeah, interesting. You're talking about different facets of the same thing. The question is of what side you come in on. I think that in this particular case, where I worked with this school, I think she was just coming from not knowing the policy. Very much what Jane's saying. I hear what you're saying, but sometimes it is more than that. You have to be careful, and sometimes it might be more. But the table I was sitting at also was talking about, sometimes you have a new teacher who it's really coming from a naivete and not coming from grooming at all. You need clarity. You need clarity. What was happening at your table? It seemed pretty vicious.
It's always vicious at our table.
Yeah.
We were grappling with the idea of part of the presentation began with kind of a positive validation and recognition of positive relationships that the teacher has with their students. And then we went back and forth whether that's really beneficial to start with that or to actually leave that entirely out of it. Whether the conversation is purely about, braiding hair and why in this today's landscape and today's age that's just something that we can't do to protect the interests of the students and of teachers, or if that's better received or better meeting is one in which, I hear so much great feedback about how you connect with your students. You're such a positive force on our faculty, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. What's the best way to get through, right?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Do you guys want to add anything? Or? Okay. And this table, we were in the best week for all. And anything from you guys? No? We're good? Okay. I'm rushing it just because I'd like to leave. Frame the question in the final discussion of the day. It's about a belief in God. It's about a kid who's doesn't believe in God.
That's
how do you handle that kind of conversation?
So
let me give it out to you here.
I don't know. For me, that's
thank you, sir. Okay. Let me read to you. This scenario. Not at all an unusual scenario. We had for the doctoral students yesterday, Dr. Utinsky, who's published about 20 articles empirically looking at some of the issues involved in kids like this, looking at the connection and the childlikeness, what's underneath it? Is it depression? Because he shows some connection there. What's underneath it? How much of it has to do with family stuff? What are predictors of kids who have very real problems in this area? Is it driven by biology? It's very complex to give a course on this at Asri Ailey, and it's a fascinating area because it's usually an interaction of many, many complex factors. One thing that you don't need me to say is that you do much better connecting through the Ahava dimension as opposed to through the Yira dimension. Let me just share with you a study and a story, okay? Because I realize we're not going to have enough time to really do this as a role play. The study is a study by Dr. Bengtson. So Dr. Bengtson, in his book Families and Faith, looked at four generations of religious transmission, okay? So he goes back to the great-grandparents. Great-grandparents, the grandparents, the parents, the kid. And you look at the great-grandchild and say, what about the family connections best predicts transmission of faith over four generations? And it's not what you think. The number one predictor of there being more or less a consistent transmission of faith is the level of closeness between the various generations, the level of warmth. It's all about warmth. It's all about today, about the Ahava dimension, not the Yira dimension. Now, that probably wasn't true 200 years ago. It's true today. We're as we just heard from my former Chavrusa, who I spent the 60s with. Okay? I can just say one thing about the 60s, how miserable the 60s were for somebody like me. I was counselor in Camp Pass their very first summer. And the rock, what was the name of that rock concert that was very famous? Woodstock. Oh, I was outside in the 60s. Woodstock was down the block from where I was the counselor. And I had my day off during Woodstock, okay? I could just walk down the street, okay? So it was about a half hour walk from Camp Pass to Woodstock. Those of you who remember Camp, okay? And guess what I did? It's one of the biggest regrets of my life. Okay? So anyway, now that I used to use the therapy session, that's what happens. That's what Tara Das does to me. So let's go. That's why I should have gone to YU. I'll tell you right now, I should have gone to YU. Okay, here it goes. So here's a conversation with a 15-year-old about belief, okay? 15-year-old who seems quite connected religiously in the past has been distracted and periodically disruptive during morning davening. It's the teacher in charge of tefillah. You're meeting with him to try to figure out what's going on. You have considerable latitude in your role in the school, including the authority to give him a failing grade for the course. You can also take even more drastic disciplinary measures, but you're also authorized to arrange alternative ways for him to spend the morning tefillah period, right? When you begin the meeting, he takes initiative and asks to be excused for morning and afternoon tefillah because he decided that he no longer believes in God. So that's quite a discussion, right? I know this table spent a long time talking about tefillah. We have people here who've done a lot of deep thinking about tefillah. And you don't need me to tell you what we know. What we know now, it, you know, is how incredibly important connecting through the Ahava dimension is. And in the Bengtson book, one of the most fascinating findings that he had is he had a subgroup called the prodigals. These are kids who left the religion. And what predicted whether or not they came back was the level of closeness between parent and child with that. So I'm going to just end with the story, okay? And then that'll be it. Here's the story. When I was growing up, it was a less complicated time, much less complicated time. I went to what's today called Hafter, then it was called High Life. Okay, it was the only school in town, okay? And it's where I went. It was very nice childhood, okay? So in our class, everybody in my cohort stayed actively Orthodox. You know, some of them flipped right, some of them maybe went a little left, but of the whole class, only two people left. And I heard one of them might have gotten a little bit into the pornography industry. Another didn't stay married within the faith. It was two, but everybody else stayed, and nobody quite knew what happened to them. We heard they moved to the West Coast. Nobody quite knew that. So I'll tell you a story that I'm telling you is true. It's going to sound made up, and it's true, okay? As opposed to the other stories.
Oh, really? Right.
The story goes like this. I'm scholar in residence in a shul on the West Coast, and I'm staying with an old classmate of mine who, you know, who was actually, I think, the president of the shul at the time. And I'm sitting next to him in shul, you know, davening. And he points out to me, the guy in the back of the shul, he said, do you recognize him? He was in our class. And it was one of the two guys. One of the two guys said, what happened to him? He's here. So he had a little kid. He said, I don't know. You know, he wasn't interested. So I go running to the guy after shul. I say, what happened to you? I heard you left and they had nothing with the revolution. Here you are with little kids. And I heard that you're sending them to the local day school. So he, you know, looked a little embarrassed. He said, look, I'll tell you. He said, you're right. I went through a pretty wild period. I totally left the religion. I had nothing to do with the religion. I did things I shouldn't have done. But I finally came back. I said, well, what did it? He said, my father never gave up on me. He just stayed connected. Now, here's where the story gets mystical, okay? Next day, I was giving a talk. The LA people here could tell me. It was in what used to be the Frank Sinatra the Fred Astaire Dance Studio. There's a day school in California that's in the auditorium. It's what used to be the Fred Astaire, whatever. So I'm on the BIMA there. I was going to be talking about parenting with Wendy Mogul, the famous parenting expert. And she spoke, and I spoke. And it's a nice-sized audience on a Sunday morning. And then I think I'm hallucinating. I could swear that I see the second guy, in back of that room. So I think, well, maybe it's a priming effect. I'm primed to see him because of what had happened the day before. But I'm not going to let it slip away from me. So as soon as we finish our talks, I jump off of the bima, I run to the back of the room, and I say, Yossi, is that you? And he says, I can't believe you recognize me. I was sent. It was there. So I said, what happened? Okay, this is pornography, man. And here's what he said. With this, I'll end. He said, my mother never stopped holding my hand. So I think that's ultimately the key. Ultimately, the key is what Benson shows, what everybody shows. You have to develop the ability in our difficult conversations to open our ears and to open our heart. And I'll end with Rav Aryeh Lubin. I just can't. Once I start telling stories, the story of Rav Aryeh Lubin, this, I promise I'm stopping. Story of Rav Aryeh Lubin. Rav Aryeh Lubin's grandson. I heard this story from him. Tells the story that Rav Aryeh Lubin was this incredibly loving man. He was Rav Hasi. You know, he was visiting prisons. He was like, he was the king of reaching out to people who were alienated and bringing them close. So there was a kid who grew up on his block, big, tall kid, who stopped being observant. You know, took his yarmulke off, started dressing in a way to clearly show that he was no longer an Oreo, all that stuff, okay? So one day, and Rabbi Levin sort of lost touch with him. He hadn't seen him. And one day, Rabbi Levin, who was a very short man, comes, sees this boy walking down the streets of his block. And he goes running after him, and he says, you know, Chaim. And Chaim sees Rav Aryeh Lubin and starts running away because he's so embarrassed. And Father Rav Aryeh Lubin catches up to him. And he says, Where have you been? I've missed you so much. And the boy says, look, Rebbe, I'm a little embarrassed. He says, you know, in fact, I'm not even wearing a yarmulke. That's why I ran away. So Rav Aryeh Lubin, who's like, you know, up to here on him, is looking at him and says, let me tell you, Chaim, from here, all I can see is your heart. Okay? Is that a nice way to end? That's the way I want.
We have Minica in 5 minutes next door.